Most people look back on their childhoods with a positive sense of nostalgia. Sometimes we forget that even back then, danger was around every corner. Today I'm joined with a Sinful Savant to bring you 5 disturbing childhood stories. I hope you enjoy, and don't forget to check the children.
Number 1.
This happened a very long time ago, back in 1973. I know it was the summer. I was 6, and we were living on Monaco Lane in Madison, Wisconsin. The thing is, I sort of recall this, but never put 2 and 2 together, until a few months ago when I was talking to my mom, who went into great detail. I was a very outgoing child, extroverted, friends with everyone. It was at the time a middle-class neighborhood, and 3 houses down from ours, on the same side of the street, was a huge park. My mom was a nurse, and my dad was a salesman. But my mom worked second shift at Meritor, while my dad worked days. I rarely had a babysitter, only if they went out for dinner or a movie. But they did go out often, and there were older kids in the neighborhood to babysit. One babysitter who I really liked lived a few blocks away and down the street a ways. Her name was Vicky, and she had babysat a few times before, and it was pretty uneventful. She played games with me and would do my hair, play dress-up, pretty basic stuff. So anyhow, one day I had gone with friends down to the park. I remember there was a ball field at the time and a sandlot next to the field. My friends wanted to play on the monkey bars, but I wanted to play in the sand. I looked at the sandbox and my babysitter Vicky was standing there. I told my friends I was going down to the sandbox and ran off. We played in the sand, building a castle, and she asked me if I wanted to go get something cold to drink. It was stifling hot, and I, of course, said yes. So she takes my hand, and we start walking to her place. She starts telling me about her puppies and asking me if I wanted to play with them. Of course, I started to get giddy, and now I can't wait to get to her house. This is where my memory stopped, and after what my mom told me, the rest of it flooded back. My mother just happened to be talking to my sister and I about some of the places we lived, and we got to talking about Monaco Lane. I told her I remembered the park and how big it seemed, and she asked me if I remembered being kidnapped. I immediately thought she was kidding, and then I saw the look on her face, and I knew that she wasn't joking. She said it was around 5 in the afternoon, and one of my friends had come to the door asking me to come back outside, sure that I had gotten bored and walked back home. When my mom checked the house, she realized that I wasn't there. 7 months pregnant with my sister, she sprints to the park, screaming my name, asking several kids if they had seen me with no clue. She went to the ball field and asked some older boys if they had seen me. One of the boys, she guessed around 14, said that he had seen a younger woman playing with a girl that fit my description in the sandbox and walked off in a general direction. And that was all he knew. My mom ran across the street to one of the houses and asked to use their phone and called the police. By the time the police got there, my dad had come home and some of the neighbors were trying to help my mom. So there's the search party out looking for me, screaming my name and knocking on doors. The police had gone back to the park to ask the boys if they knew who had been with me, and if they knew who she was. Between the boys and the neighbors, they had deduced who it was who had led me off, but I have no idea how, honestly. The police and the entourage go to her home. She lived with her parents, but they weren't home. They knocked on the door. She came to the door and told them that she hadn't seen me, and that she had been home all day. The police asked to come in, and for some reason she said okay. They went through the house and went to the basement and found me. That's what my mom knew. And then I remembered. It was literally like a floodgate had opened and I started crying. At 6, you sort of trust everyone and she had been in our home. I never got a bad feeling from her and my parents didn't either. But when we walked into her house, I remember that cold, holy fuck feeling washing over me and getting very worried. I remember starting to cry and saying that I wanted to go home, over and over. She takes me into her kitchen and gets me a glass of water and a tissue. I hear dogs barking, and next to the kitchen is an open stairway that went down to where the barking was coming from. She starts trying to coax me into going downstairs, telling me there's all sorts of toys and games. I reluctantly agree, and she grabs my hand and starts to head down the stairs. The dogs are going nuts, and I start screaming. At this point, Vicky is starting to get very fucking bizarre. She begins screaming at me, "Shut the fuck up! If you don't shut up, I will throw you in the cage with the dogs!" Dragging me down the stairs and still screaming. I was scared out of my mind. I remember crying so hard that I was hyperventilating. I'm screaming so hard that I'm no longer making any noise. Vicky then flips a switch and starts being sweet again, trying to calm me down. She tells me that she was just playing a game, and then says that she wants to play hide and seek. She must have been relatively skilled at calming me down, because the next thing I know, I hear knocking on the door from upstairs, and I was no longer crying. The houses were all very similar, not huge but not small, but you could hear everything at any spot in the house. I kept hearing the knocking, and she tells me that it's her friends. They're coming to play hide and seek. She convinced me to let her put a piece of masking tape over my mouth so I wouldn't make a sound, and lifted me into this big wooden box next to the kennel. She put a big pile of blankets over me and told me to be very quiet so they wouldn't find me. The whole time the dogs were going batshit, but when she calmed me down, they calmed down too. They still looked incredibly mean, but they were no longer frothing at the mouth and now only slightly growling. Until the knocking started again. I remember scrunching in there, confused, still scared, and convinced that the dogs were going to get out and devour me. I was crying again and hyperventilating. I remember taking the tape off my mouth because I couldn't breathe, but I stayed quiet because I was afraid of what she would do if I screamed. I laid in that smelly box next to a big bag of dog food, sweating like hell, tears rolling down my face. I sort of pushed the blankets off to the side, but only enough so that I could pull them back over me whenever someone came. I recall thinking about my dad and wondering if he would come and find me. All of a sudden, I heard what sounded like adults calling my name. They came downstairs and the dogs were going batshit again. Over and over, men were yelling my name. And then I heard a man say, "If you don't shut those fucking dogs up, I will." I was in a large storage box, like a carpenter's toolbox type of thing, with tape hanging off my mouth. When they opened the lid, I remembered a very nice man asking me my name and if I was okay. I don't remember answering him in anything other than screams and tears and grabbing his neck so hard, my dad had to practically pry me off of him. I remember my parents taking me to the hospital to be checked out, and I can't really remember anything else after that. Mom said that Vicky was found guilty of attempted kidnapping, and last she knew, she was in prison, but couldn't remember last time that she heard anything. We moved from the area shortly thereafter, and I haven't been back since. I do know that Mom said that her parents were odd, but that they didn't really know them. She had met Vicky from neighbors that had used her as a babysitter. They never heard of anything bad, and that I always seemed happy with her. She lived in the general neighborhood, but it was two blocks over. Mom said they never picked her up. She always walked over. They would drive her home, but never noticed anything out of the ordinary. Mom and Dad only met her parents when they came to the door to ask for forgiveness. They told them that Vicky hadn't meant to do anything bad, and that she was a good girl. My mom said that my dad picked her dad up by the shirt and told them that if they ever came to our property again, he would kill them. I remember her name and sort of what she looked like, but I doubt that I would recognize her if she walked up to me today. The dogs were huge Rottweilers. To a child, they seemed like hellhounds.
Number 2.
Some backstory before I begin. These events started when I was in second or third grade, 2002 or 2003-ish, and ended during the fall of 2015. I'm a 21-year-old female living in Canada. RCMP equals Royal Canadian Mounted Police. When I was in elementary school, I was friends with a girl named Jessica. We had a group of 5 or 6 girls that we always played with. Jessica's parents were divorced, and I often went over to her dad's house after school because they had a trampoline and a slide. Her dad was a totally normal dude. His name was Richard, and he held a job as a pilot, which is definitely a job that requires mental stability. Jessica came over to my house as well, and her dad would always come pick her up after the playdate, so he was familiar with where I lived. In I think 2nd or 3rd grade, Jessica moved away to live with her mom. I didn't fully understand what was going on as a child, and I still don't know what happened, but something had gone wrong with her father. We didn't hear much from Jessica, but around her birthday, the following year, Richard invited our group of girls over for a surprise birthday party. We arrived at the party and were waiting for Jessica so we could surprise her, but Jessica never showed up. We were just hanging out with her dad for a while. As a child, this didn't seem as weird as it does to me now. When our parents picked us up, we obviously told them what happened, and we didn't hang out with Jessica or Richard again. After that, some of the girls started receiving presents from Richard at their homes. I never received them, but my mother told me about it years later. The presents usually consisted of cheap jewelry and notes. I have no idea what the notes said, but I'm not sure that I want to. After this, Richard goes away. My mom later told me he was in a mental institution. Years go by. I completely forget about the whole situation. Then, in the winter of 2013, I was out of town for a cheer competition. I was scrolling through Facebook one night, when all of a sudden a new group chat popped up with 5 girls from my elementary school. I had not kept in touch with any of them, so this was weird. The chat was about how they received messages from Richard on Facebook. I checked the other folder of my Facebook messages, and sure enough, I had some too. I had a variety of messages that did not make a lot of sense, including some strange poems. Many of the messages were descriptions of dreams he had about me. Though some of them were nonsense, others were understandable enough to come across as sexually violent and threatening. I don't feel comfortable sharing some of the more explicit messages, but here are a couple of the shorter and less scary ones. Hi, little girl from not long ago. Pristine of pristineness, I want you. I want you. I want you. We're gonna have planets to go to someday, provided you don't melt them first. I'm so proud of you. Stay happy, and I haven't found a way to keep you all off my mind. I can't see the planets till I make you all mine. You're just so rough, and oh, just so fine. As if I'm there, my love's for you. For you I share. It's so indefinite, for it's all about you, that I only care. Oh my goodness, you're all my whipping cream containers. I clicked on Richard's Facebook profile, and his whole profile was dedicated to us 5 girls. He didn't have any friends added, so clearly nobody had seen it. Unfortunately, we didn't have very good security settings on Facebook. He had saved dozens of photos of us, and then reposted them with nonsensical and inappropriate captions. The captions ranged from essays about his love for us to a one-sentence caption that simply said, "She is so ugly." Here are some of the shorter photo captions. "Emily, hopefully, and not too soon, I'm gonna find out where your YXX8511, and I'm gonna show up as a man, then knock on your front doorstep and bite your bottom lip off before you can say a word. Sierra, because my initial euphoria turns into sunken depression when I realize that there's nothing I can do about anything besides you because you're inside me and I can't get you out of my mind. I love you so much. Melissa, can I paint your picture? And I want to lift you around to see how heavy you are, and we'll go for a drive on Hollywood Drive with the windows rolled down so we can get a crystal clear view." God, give it up. Like as if I'm going to pretend I like it besides you're just yanking on my strings. Because time after time, it's always the same common denominator. Which I noticed how come you all pluck your eyebrows. But I do pretend I have favorite things. But in reality, I don't need them. And I'm a good liar because I have a criminal mind like yours. We were all freshly 18 at the time and didn't know what to do. So our moms contacted the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They told us not to block Richard on Facebook, but not to reply as messages could be used as evidence. He continued to send us messages every single day, and we shared the screenshots with each other in the group chat and sent them off to the RCMP. He had several different Facebook accounts that were all variations of his name, along with one randomly named Esteban. One of the girls got in touch with Jessica to find out if she still had contact with her father. She only saw him on supervised visits every once in a while. She was very embarrassed and apologized a lot. She was a super sweet girl, and obviously none of us were upset at her in any way. Eventually, Richard was charged with 5 counts of criminal harassment. He pled guilty and went to jail for around 5 months. When he got out, there was still a no-contact order in place, meaning that he could not contact any of us girls or come within a certain radius of our homes. He was not allowed to use the internet either. I'm not sure how all of this works, but this is what the constable handling the case told me. However, not surprisingly, he started contacting us on Facebook again. He went back to jail for breaching his probation. It was the summer of 2015 and he got out again. I started receiving more messages. I immediately wrote on the group chat to see if the other girls had gotten anything. They hadn't. It was just me. I immediately contacted the police. It seems they had forgotten to include my name on the no contact order. He knew not to contact the other girls, but thought it was still safe for him to contact me. This time things got worse. I had just started working at a new job, and being the idiot that I am, I had my workplace public on my Facebook profile. One day I came into work and there was a package waiting for me. I was obviously confused because I would never order something to be delivered to my work. I opened it up with my managers, and there was weed inside along with a disc with encryption software on it. He had mailed me weed to my work. I knew immediately that this was him, and awkwardly explained the situation to my managers, who thought it was hilarious. The security in my office tower was alerted and given a photo of him. They began walking me to my bus stop after my shifts. It was scary knowing that he knew where I worked. At this point, I hadn't seen Richard in years, but it was clear that he was mentally unwell. I had absolutely no idea what he was capable of or what his motives were. The RCMP did not seem to take this case very seriously, and they moved very slowly, passing the case around to various officers. Meanwhile, I was terrified. I could hardly walk down my street at night without freaking out. Every time somebody knocked on my door while I was home alone, I would drop whatever I was doing and hide under the kitchen counters. I had not moved since I was a child, so it was very possible that he remembered where I lived. The packages kept coming. I received more weed in several different forms, including cookies, what appeared to be cocaine, and a key to his apartment, along with some miscellaneous items. I opened all of the packages at the police station. One of the packages included a USB stick with a bunch of audio recordings on them, but I decided it was better for me not to listen to them. The return address on the packages was to a random PO box in another city that did not belong to Richard, and no fingerprints were found on the packages. During all of this, the Facebook messages remained constant. Luckily, in one of the messages, he informed me that he had sent me drugs and the key along with his home address. This confirmed that the packages were from him. He was charged again. I received a subpoena in the mail to appear as a witness in court. However, he once again pled guilty and never got to go to court. I was actually a bit disappointed, as I thought seeing him in person would provide me with some sort of closure. He's still locked up somewhere as I'm writing this, but I still get scared walking at night or when somebody knocks on the door. The police provided me zero information on where he was being held or when he would be released. I feel like I'm just waiting for the day that he will contact me again. It seems as if every time I think it's over, it isn't. This situation could have been a lot worse, and as far as I know, he did not physically follow me around or anything. I strongly encourage you all to make sure your Facebook privacy settings are as private as possible.
Number 3.
First things first, I'm a Norwegian, so I apologize for any grammar mistakes. I hope you can look past it. Second, this story does not have an answer or a solution, and I still wonder about it to this day. I grew up in a small town on the south coast of Norway. My neighborhood was on a dirt road, about a kilometer long, with 8 houses. I had relatives and family in 5 of them. On either side of the road were wide open fields that my uncle rented to a sheep farmer in the summer. About halfway down the road was my grandmother's house, and just before that, her old garage, where my uncle kept his tractor. The doors to the garage were always open. My house was the second one on the end, just around a turn that was down by the river and almost hidden in the trees. When spending time at my friend's house, I would use the shortcut by the river to get home. So it all started the autumn when I was 7 years old. I was walking home from my friend's house around 6 in the evening by myself. It started to get dark. I was walking down the dirt road, thinking my childish thoughts, using the light of the moon to guide me, as there were no street lights. Just before I turned down the dirt road that led to my home, behind the hill was a house that you could hardly see from the main road. I was walking and kicking rocks as I went, when I heard somebody whistling at me from the trees. It was obvious that it was meant to catch my attention. It wasn't just some innocent melody someone would be whistling to themselves. I raised my head and looked into the woods to see where it was coming from, but I couldn't see anything. I never stopped walking, but I picked up my pace. I didn't hear the whistling for a while, meaning the person wasn't following me, and I got home safe. This continued almost every time I walked past this area, but only when I was alone. I almost became used to it, and even started calling it the whistling spot. Occasionally, I had my sister's bike, and would ride past the spot as fast as I could. A couple of years passed this way before it started escalating. I think it was early spring when I was about 9. I walked past the spot and didn't hear anything. At first, I was relieved, but after a moment, I began to feel uneasy. Why would it suddenly stop now? It was like I was getting used to walking by a vicious barking dog that was chained. You're nervous but start to feel a sense of ease knowing the chain will hold. Then suddenly you walk by one day and the dog is gone, and you're worried that it might have broken free. Trying to be grateful for not being whistled at that night, I chose to keep my guard up as I continued to walk down the dark road. As I was nearing my grandmother's house, I heard something that made my heart drop. With the wide open doors, I heard the whistle. I stopped dead in my tracks. I probably went so pale I glowed in the dark. But I didn't hear any other sounds of any kind coming from the garage. No shuffling. No murmuring. Not even breathing. I sprinted up the road as fast as I could run, past the garage, hoping the door to the house wasn't locked. Fortunately, it wasn't, and I never felt so relieved in my life. I locked the door behind me, sank to the floor, and started sobbing. It took just seconds before my grandmother, uncle, and older cousin were in the hallway, wondering who came bursting in and slammed the door. It took a couple of minutes before I had calmed down enough to explain what happened. My uncle went outside and searched the entire garage, but didn't find anything. My grandmother called my father, who was there in a matter of minutes. My uncle went to get his hunting rifle, and he, my father, and cousin went outside to further check the area, but they didn't find any sign of a prowler. I remember feeling fortunate that they believed me, but I had always been an honest child after all. My father took me home, and for those few short minutes heading back up the road to my house, I felt safe, and that the worst was behind me. When we pulled into the driveway, the whistling started again. It was coming from the forest alongside the house. My father went berserk, but my sobbing deterred him from running into the woods like a madman. He took me inside, called the cops, and stayed up with me until they arrived. The police showed up 20 minutes later and were unable to find anything. They checked the house by the whistling spot, the garage, and the woods, but couldn't even find footprints. It was the last time I heard the whistle. My parents bought me my own bike, and after about 2 weeks of being escorted everywhere, I was tired of the attention and started biking by myself again. Even though I'm an adult now and have moved across the country, every time I'm visiting my folks, walking past the garage or the whistling spot, it still gives me the creeps, and I half expect to hear it start again. I still wonder who it was and what their reason was for doing it.
Number 4.
So I've mentioned this before and people always ask questions, so I figured I would post it here. When I was a little kid, my father was diagnosed with schizophrenia. It quickly became very severe. He started thinking the FBI was after him, becoming incredibly paranoid. He got into legal trouble for abusing 911. From what my mom told me, he started accruing a variety of really sketchy friends, other severely mentally ill people, drunks, druggies, prostitutes, other homeless people. One day he didn't come home from work. This was before cell phones, but when my mom called his work, they said he had left and everything seemed normal. She called our family members, some of his real friends from before he got sick, coworkers, and a ton of other people. Nobody knew anything. Nobody had seen him. When he didn't show up at home by bedtime, my mom called the police and explained to them that my dad had left without any of his belongings, except for his wallet and his car, and nobody knew where he was. They eventually agreed to allow her to file a missing persons case. His car was found abandoned outside a shopping center 2 weeks later in New Jersey, 200 miles away from our home in Maryland. Since then, there have been no developments in the case. No activity on his credit cards. No family or friends have heard from him. He's considered an endangered missing, and the detective on the case suspects foul play. Fast forward 15 years. I'm attending college 6 hours away from home, living in a rented house off campus with a few friends. While I'm at class one day, two disheveled-looking middle-aged men knock on my door and in a very polite tone ask for me by my full name, saying they need to speak to me, that they are friends of my father. My roommate said they seemed friendly enough at that point, and he started asking them normal questions: who they were, if they wanted to leave a message, how I could contact them when I got home. They gave really dodgy answers and kept turning the questions back on me. Where was I? Could they get my cell phone number? Was the car in the driveway with the Maryland tags mine? My roommate told me that he started getting horrible vibes from them and said he was going to call the police, slamming the door on them. They immediately bolted. My roommate worked with a sketch artist affiliated with the detective on my dad's case. Nobody recognizes those guys. We never saw them or heard from them again.
Number 5.
So my story needs a little backstory first. I am and always have been a very small girl, standing at 4'11", fully grown now at 27, and I've always been able to pass as being much younger than I am, especially when I'm not wearing makeup. When I was a small child of about 7 or 8, my father bought a little cabin in a town called Livingston. It was located in Texas. It was in an area of Livingston called Onalaska. I specify because of the second part of the story. Anyone with kids needs to be wary of the area. The cabin was really nothing remarkable, at only 600 square feet. It was really just one giant room, a teeny kitchen the size of a normal bathroom, and a bathroom the size of a large closet. There was also a porch out front. The whole property consisted of two lots, so there was plenty of space, but the cabin itself was dinky. This whole area was a strange mix between backwoods and suburbia. It was a neighborhood, but not one of those neatly kept neighborhoods I was used to back in Houston. Despite this, it became a very fond place for me, and some of my greatest memories in life are at that cabin, including my evacuation story from Houston during Hurricane Rita, but that's a story for another day. Anyways, around 11 or 12 years old, my father bought me a four-wheeler, and the little lake town suddenly became a lot bigger. I didn't go super far, but I definitely ended up going further than I ever had gone before. It was quite common to see me zipping up and down the roads with a pile of neighborhood kids on the back of the four-wheeler when we would go up to the lake house on weekend visits. This was around 2001 or 2002, so cell phones were a thing, but it was still common for people not to have them. Usually I had a beeper that I carried around. But with no phones at the lake house, my father gave me a walkie-talkie with a very long reach instead. Looking back on it now from a world of cell phones, this seems like a bad idea. But this was a small town, and we spent so much time here that it felt safe. So on one of these weekends, I was buzzing around my neighborhood like I usually did, and I stopped at this peninsula that had a great overview of the lake. This was a set of docks that us kids came to when we wanted to swim, despite the very real threat of giant alligators. But being us stupid kids, we really didn't worry about that. I was overlooking the lake when my walkie-talkie buzzed to life. Naturally thinking it was my parents trying to reach me, I answered it quickly. I couldn't quite make out what they said at first, so I tried confirming that it was my dad. This point in the neighborhood was a ways away from the cabin, but I had reached my parents from this point before, so despite the fact I couldn't recognize the voice, I assumed it was my dad. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary at first. I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but it was off enough that I remember being slightly annoyed, garbled questions that I answered, but no answers that would have hinted who or where I was. Eventually, the conversation started to drift in a way that I knew something was off, but I was not alarmed just yet. My dad was notorious for pulling pranks on me and goofing around. I kept talking, stupidly. Alarm bells weren't going off just yet. Finally though, the guy on the other end of the walkie-talkie made a comment. I cannot for the life of me remember what he said exactly, but it was enough to make me doubt that it was my father. This is when things took an extremely creepy turn. Bear in mind, I had been talking to this guy pretending to be my father for about 15 minutes, sitting on my four-wheeler on this peninsula.
I can see you. You should come take a ride on my boat.
My father had a boat, but this was so out of character that it made me realize that it wasn't my father. Dad? You're not my dad, are you?
What are you talking about?
If you can see me, I started, feeling a bit pissed that this guy had been messing with me. If you can see me, what am I wearing? He paused for a second, before the walkie-talkie crackled to life. He said, very clearly,
You're wearing an orange shirt. You have red hair, and you're sitting on a four-wheeler right by the swim docks. Why don't you come ride in my boat?
At this point, my eyes widened, and my blood ran cold. This entire time, some strange guy that I didn't know had been watching me from God knows where. It took maybe 10 seconds to look around wildly, and then kick the four-wheeler up and race out of there so fast that the wheels had a hard time catching the ground. I remember the wheels spun out against the gravel beneath them, and when the four-wheeler finally started moving, little me had a hard time holding on. I floored it the entire way home. I stopped in the middle of the yard and burst into the house. Obviously, the first thing I did was ask my parents if they had contacted me, which they had not, and hadn't for a few hours. I was in such a panic that my father would have confessed had it been him. He was a practical joker, but he knew when the fun was over. I hate to think what might have happened if I continued sticking around that area. Nothing ever came of this incident though, and my childhood up there resumed as normal. Eventually the weekend visit stopped, but the story does not end there. During my parents' divorce, I moved to live at the lake house permanently with my father, or at least until we could find something better. This was the only place we could go after he left my mother, which is a long story by itself, but I won't get into that here. My father had recently suffered from a lot of health issues, so I took a job at a nearby gas station tobacco barn to pay bills and let him recuperate. Thankfully, the lake house had no bills save for the electricity, water, and internet. so my small salary was enough to keep us going. I only worked there for about 3 months, but those 3 months were by far the creepiest I had ever experienced. Within the first month, a rather tall and obese man became infatuated with me, and he couldn't have been creepier. He had short crew-cut hair and a slightly unkempt beard and mustache combo. The first time we ran into each other, he stared at me with these wide, crazy eyes while ordering his gas, and just stood there for 2 to 3 solid minutes just staring. When I asked if I could help him, he said nothing. Now, the part of the tobacco barn I worked in was strictly the gas side, and I was pretty much in a glass box with an opening to take people's money and give them their cigarettes, which I could not have been more thankful for. Several times that this man came to visit, he would pump his gas after staring at me awkwardly. After about the 4th or 5th time after he had left, I hear a knock on the other side of the barn on the glass. There he was, face pressed against the glass, staring at me with this wide, manic grin, and waving at me with just his fingers. It was enough to send me running to my manager when he left, demanding that I go on break before I pissed myself. The last time I saw him, I will never forget. It has been so etched into my mind so deeply that I doubt bleach could scrub it away. He arrives, as he usually did, and orders his gas. This time, however, he reaches through the hole in the glass and grabbed my hand before I could put the cash away in the register drawer. It wasn't a violent grab, but it was firm enough to keep me from pulling away. Being a very sheltered 18-year-old, I froze in place.
"I love you,"
he said, refusing to let go of my hand. I simply stared at him, unnerved, and alarm bells ringing in my head.
"Say it."
"What?" I responded.
"Say, you love me."
Naturally, I just wanted this guy to go away, and being so freaking scared out of my mind at this point, I stammered and said it out of impulse. "I love you?" I said uneasily.
"Call me if you need anything. What's my number?"
he asked. This threw me off completely, and a look on my face probably gave away my confusion, because he repeated himself, despite my stammering that I didn't know. Finally, he said something that made my blood turn to ice. I felt like I was going to throw up.
"It's 911.
He winked. This guy was the sheriff deputy, the person I would have to call if I got into any sort of trouble in town, the person I would have to call if I had a medical emergency or if someone tried to rob me, and he wouldn't let go of my hand. I just nodded, trying to keep myself from shaking bad enough for him to feel it. He never pulled up in a police car or anything, but when I talked to my manager, she confirmed what he was saying was true. He eventually let go of me and went on his way. I retreated to the back and demanded to be relieved from the gas station area. I didn't care. I did not want to see that guy ever again. Thankfully, we moved soon after, so I never had to. But I will never forget the leering grin that man gave me every single time he purchased gasoline. You would think moving away would be the end of the story, but no. It got even worse when I went to college. And you wouldn't think that would be the case, considering I was in Galveston. I had needed to go to my counselor to discuss a few things, and this usually involved about 30 minutes of chit-chat. As me and my counselor had become close while I was attending school, I mentioned Onalaska, Texas, and how he owned a lake house up there. Instantly, the happy expression left my counselor's face. She informed me that she had been a social worker in that area for quite a few years. And suddenly my childhood playground took an extremely dark turn, and the sheriff at the gas station became a nightmare. Apparently the area was notorious for pedophilia, kidnappings, and other horrible incidents. Whole neighborhoods, including police officers, were in on it, and it was common for people trying to out the incidents to either go missing or be completely thrown out of the community through intimidation tactics. She proceeded to tell me of several cases that she had worked on, including occurrences of entire families being in on the whole mess. When I told her about the sheriff I had encountered, she kind of paled and wouldn't tell me any more, except that she wasn't surprised. The conversation went on for over an hour and a half, but it was enough to make me never want to return to the small town I had called my childhood summer home, and vowed to never ever bring any children I might have in the future there.
There's always a reason to be afraid.